Hello and welcome to Deep Fried Planet with me, Pat Thomas. Today we are talking about energy, and I know mine is certainly flagging at the moment, but not that kind of energy. We're talking about microgeneration, clean, green energy generated on a local scale. It's a subject so important that the last government made it a goal to have 10% of our national energy generated in this way, well, by this year, and 20% by 2020. Reports into the energy landscape of the UK suggest that if we get our skates on, 30% of the UK's energy demands could be met by local generation by 2050. Of course, microgeneration has been in the news this week, and not for any of the right reasons. Across the board, funding cuts by the coalition government mean that early adopters of microgeneration, householders who were amongst the first, for instance, to put in solar panels, are not going to get the payments, the feed-in tariffs that they were promised for supplying energy back to the national grid. These feed-in tariffs were seen as an essential carrot to encourage people to adopt microgeneration. So what's the incentive now? And if you want to do the right thing, regardless of the fiscal incentives, where do you start? My guests today, who are right in the thick of the local energy revolution, should be able to tell us a bit more. With me is Mary Walsh, a lawyer and an expert in renewable energy development. Mary devotes her time and portfolio of skills to helping groups develop and or finance new energy initiatives. Also with me is Chas Warlow, project manager at one of London's most ambitious microgeneration projects, Ham Hydro, a social enterprise which is harnessing the power of community to bring clean hydroelectricity to the residents on both sides of Teddington Weir on the River Thames. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Mary, I'm going to come to you first. I think for a lot of us, energy is something that somebody else makes and we use. So why suddenly have community sustainable energy programs become so important in the UK?
Hi. I think there's a number of reasons for this, and I think it probably, you've got to look at the national picture first of all, which is that about 10 years ago we became a net importer of gas and oil. So the North Sea's dwindling and we are now reliant on other countries for our oil and gas. When that happens, you've got a security of supply issue. So as a country, we start to look to our own resources, and being an island, we're particularly blessed with wind resources. So I think that's the first thing that came to everybody's mind. Hydro's been here for a long time. And more recently, more and more solar panels are appearing. When you do that and you start to look collectively as a nation at what resources you have, I think then by extension, local communities then start to look at what resources there are in their area. So it's gone from being a kind of international issue to actually people going, there is a resource on my doorstep, why am I not using it? And it's intuitive. I mean, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to be importing our energy from the Middle East and from Africa when we have resources on the door. At the same time, I think it's all part of the kind of local movement. Recently, the local food movement, there's been a real growth in community enterprises and so on. And I think that it's just two things coming together at the one time quite fortuitously.
There are, you touched on some of them, lots of different types of microgeneration in every kind of scale, from biomass boilers and solar panels to larger wind turbines and, of course, hydropower. How does a community choose, and what conditions have to be in place for a community group to develop its own energy supply?
I think the first thing that needs to be in place is that kind of spark of enthusiasm. I mean, that's the frequently found amongst community groups when something starts, people will then go, what else can we do? And what else is there out there that we can invest our time and energies into? In terms of what kind of projects people look to, I think it really does depend on where you are. If you're next to a river, if you're next to a weir, then it's a pretty logical conclusion to go, actually, this seems to make sense. Equally, though, if you know, you, for example, I'm thinking of schools and so on. If you've got a school with a huge flat roof or a slightly tilted roof that faces south, then it kind of is logical. Well, why aren't there solar panels on there? Why isn't that roof generating electricity that will generate electricity for the school itself, but also make it some money that can be used for other projects?
Well, that leads us really neatly onto Ham Hydro, because of course you're right there on the river, and you've just beaten off all kinds of big guys to produce your own local energy.
It was a big process. The Environment Agency is the landlord of Teddington Weir. Now that's in our patch of land. We people who created the group of the team of Ham Hydro live mainly in Ham, which is in Richmond. It's part of the borough of Richmond. And, of course, the Weir, is in the river, and in the River Thames, and the group that you know we formed, just looked at the possibilities and thought, well, we really want to do something. It's a group that's really focused around doing things in the local environment to improve it, to improve people's quality of life, and that's how it all started. And do you want me to really go into the whole process?
Well, I'd be interested to know, did you just come together as a bunch of strangers, or had you done some work on sustainability locally before?
Mainly, we knew each other from other projects that we'd already started. I mean, some of them are, you know, to do with food growing. As Mary was talking about, there are other initiatives around, like you can create a local allotment for the community, things like that. So, yeah, some of us already knew each other, and then other people joined. You might think fortuitously, but I think it's still that energy that Mary was talking about that's in the air at the moment, and people really want to get involved and do something effective and clean and green. And so we did gather a number of people who have experience and skills that were really useful.
And I mean, that to me is a really interesting question, because there have got to be a lot of practicalities, there have got to be a lot of pitfalls of putting something like this together. Mary, I know you help advise on things like that. How do people get started, generally speaking, and what do they need to look out for?
I think the enthusiasm that comes from within a community group is definitely, for me, the most important thing that can kickstart the process. But I think after that, you have to start thinking a bit more like a business than a community group. You have to start looking at where all the bits of the jigsaw are, who owns the land, what rights do you need, what planning permissions do you need, who do you have to speak to get those, how are we going to fund this, all of those kind of things. And in terms of the skills that are needed for it, I think it's always amazing to see just how many skills people have, and they may not even necessarily know that they have them. It's quite an interesting, if you actually say to someone, you know, would you like to, you know, can you go and speak to the Environment Agency? And this isn't their normal day-to-day job, but they're very used to speaking to another government department, or, you know, they're used to dealing with the public. And all of those skills, we all have transferable skills, and it's just a case of finding those skills and using them in the right place.
Yeah, and also, you know, believing that you can make the project work, even though there are obstacles that are bound to be set in your way sometimes. Because, you know, that's part of the whole learning curve that you put yourself on, and it's an experience in itself.
Well, it sounds like a no-brainer. You know, we're going to create this great clean energy source, but there are bound to be, not everybody's opinions about these things tend to be positive. There are bound to be people, there must be maybe, I don't know, anglers or something
yeah,
that were not very happy about the idea of having a hydropower on the Thames. How do you deal with that?
Well, in our specific case, the technology that we're planning to use is, you know, in inverted commas, fish friendly. That means that it's been shown in tests to cause no damage to any aquatic life. And in fact, the Environment Agency itself has approved that technology. So in terms of just having the bald facts in front of us, you know, that's already there. And as far as we need to, of course, we will engage with any group that feels that they have a potential objection or a viable objection. So anglers are obviously going to be people that we're going to talk to. In fact, we have already made contact with them, and I want to bring them into this community project rather than, you know, see it as a case of, well, it's us and then there are all these people that we have to appease. Well, no, you know, in fact, it's a joint effort. It really does have a community interest, so let's look at it that way.
And did you have any kind of blueprint for this? I think there are other hydro schemes around the UK, aren't there?
Yeah, there's a couple of in particular. They're up north, and they had already set up their own company and gone through a whole share issue to raise funding. But they're much smaller, comparatively smaller schemes than the one that we're planning. But certainly that is a useful blueprint, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Mary, can you tell me a little bit more about what people need to do to sort of get themselves together? Do they need to form a company? Do they need to become businessmen overnight or what?
No, I think the main thing is that kind of element of common sense that comes to it. And with my lawyer hat on, I like to see the liabilities in one place. So the danger you have as a community group, particularly if you're going to be engaging with contractors and so on, for, you know, these contracts can be worth hundreds of thousands of pounds, is you don't want anybody to be individually liable for that. So my recommendation is always that people form themselves into some collective unit, be it a community interest company or an industrial and provident society. I know that there are various different structures that can be used, and it does depend on the kind of project and how you envisage the project going forward. In terms of, do you need to be a businessman overnight? No.
But, that would put me off right away.
No, not at all. But at the same time, I do think that there are elements of that discipline that comes from running a business that really do need to be applied to here, because you are talking about very, very valuable contracts, about very valuable installations, and about things that are going to generate a profit, and in many cases, a fairly sizable profit. So you need to apply some of that discipline from the business world to make it run as efficiently as possible, and you know, really to make it run in the best interests of the community as a whole, I would say.
And before you generate that profit, presumably you've got to get some money behind you as well to make things work. I'd be interested to hear how you did it at Ham Hydro, and also to get some from you, Mary, some general advice on that.
Well, Ham Hydro, the part of the process and part of the reason I was laughing earlier is because it was been such a long process of persuading or being involved with the Environment Agency to be given this chance to develop that particular site, because it was effectively a competitive tender. And so we've only just been told, really, that, you know, it's us, you know, well done, you've got the opportunity, now go ahead and deal with it. So we're still, you know, because although we've been working on it for a long time, we haven't, you know, there hasn't been a project for us to go out and ask for money for. So we're still at that early stage.
And how do you go about that in general, Mary? How does someone go about raising the funds for a project like this? Where do they go? Are there grants? Are there philanthropists out there? What?
There are sources of funding out there. That's the good news. The slightly less good news is, of course, that government grants are becoming less and less frequent. Not least because the coalition is tightening its belt all over the place. So there is less government money available. That said, there is still some. And it is a case of going out and looking for it. It's worth talking to people who've done it before, like the projects that are in the north of England and so on, seeing how they got started. If you speak to even the Carbon Trust, the Renewable Energy Association, and particularly the regional development authorities, I know the LDA has got a space on its website for where that kind of grant funding's available. Next step, there are philanthropists out there. There's a number of philanthropic funds that are actively looking at this sector, because it's a social investment, and it's a positive social investment that generally ticks a number of the boxes that they're looking for whenever they're investing their money. And then subsequent to that, once it kind of gets moving and you have a viable project, you can't underestimate that, you know, banks are willing to lend to these kind of projects. The feed-in tariffs are there. They do give a guaranteed revenue for a period of years. So it makes it quite a stable investment. And I think that probably in over the course of the coming years, as people become more and more familiar with them, there are going to be other funds that are out there that will be willing to invest in these kind of projects.
And having got that in place, Chas, what process are you in now? I mean, how long is it going to take before you start?
Oh, before building?
Yeah. Tell me the story.
The story about construction and actually kind of completing this whole installation from start to finish. Well, first of all, you have to go through various periods of monitoring, because you have to say, well, this is the state of the river before, and then once you've constructed, you then go through another period of monitoring. Of course, you need to look at the environmental impacts, possible impacts. So that's something that happens before construction. There are also various permits that you need to, because you're working on with water, and that involves a whole range of different issues. So there's this kind of planning process. Oh, of course, planning procedure, planning the development itself. So there's this whole procedure that happens before you even start, you know, getting into the water and starting to build. Mm. So we would hope to have the construction happening in 2012 and be completed at the end of the summer.
Right.
That's the timescale.
It's extraordinary because I think, as I said in the beginning, we have this kind of lack of engagement with where our energy comes from and how it gets to us. And I would imagine that this is a real eye-opener. Any kind of project like this must be, because you suddenly realize how complex it is to get all that juice that comes in. And, you know, you flick on a switch and the lights go on, but you have no idea where it actually comes from. Does it change the way that communities look at energy? Does it change the way that they use energy once they start doing this?
That's going to be a really interesting question. I'm not sure if anyone's done any research into this, because I think that would be definitely worthy of research. I would have said that over time it ought to certainly make people more aware of that whole process that you just described, that we tend to take completely for granted, and that you would then think a lot more about your energy use.
I think it's part of the whole education process when it comes to energy. I mean, Charles is talking about a timescale of a couple of years, but if you're looking at some of the really complex offshore developments that are going on at the minute, you can be talking up to 10 years. And if we can get people asking those questions, wondering how things happen, why things happen, then I think people do generally think more about their energy use and so on, and I think that's only going to be a good thing.
Well, I think there's a tendency when people resist these sort of developments to sort of dismiss it as NIMBYism, but I don't think it is. I think there's a huge psychological shift that comes with sort of generating your own energy, and it has to kind of resonate with your own values, and has to resonate with the time that people have to devote to the project and with their views of their own community. That's why I'm asking whether you think, or whether you have any stories of the way that it might change a community's look at energy, because I think I have
a story, because the Isle of Egg in where is it, the Outer
Fantastic,
Hebrides,
yes,
yeah, they now generate, I think they're completely off grid, I think so, and part of that has been, I think, a process where they've realized what they needed and they've thought about their energy use, and then they've kind of planned how to generate it, and the generation of it has given it an extra kind of value to them.
Absolutely, and it gives a new, I want to say personality, but, you know, the village itself or the island itself then becomes this whole other creature than it was before. It's not just some rock in the Outer Hebrides. Yeah. It's this self-sufficient, really motivated group of people who are trying to live sustainably.
Absolutely.
And I think that's why the government, I suspect, though I don't know, one of the reasons why the government is so keen on local energy generation is because it's the one way to get people engaged. If you just set targets and say, we must cut our carbon footprint by, you know, 60% by 2050 or whatever, most people, I think, would just go, yeah, all right, well, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Exactly. No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that it does create a huge kind of focal point for community action and community pride and coherence as well. So, I mean, I think this kind of project has this kind of added value, which, as you're saying, is one reason why the government is really trying to help or promote or at least put the idea forward that we can do this.
How do you prevent the kind of burnout? Now, I've worked with some local food groups, and inevitably there is one person who's driving it. It's their energy, it's their vision, it's their spark that's driving it. And I think the burnout rate is something like 3 or 4 years with local food groups. They just, you know, you can only supply food to the community for so long before you just say, I've had enough. It's got to be the same with driving a project like this. How do you combat that sort of thing?
I don't know that there's one definitive answer to it. I think the possibly one of the differences between a food group and an energy group is the range of people that you need to involve in an energy group means that people tend to have quite distinct roles within that group. And again, coming back to the idea of running it a bit like a business, there has to be that case that if somebody drops out, that actually you need to fill that space with somebody who has those kind of skills. I think it's always a balancing act, because that's one of the problems, especially when projects get going, is that people are doing this on a voluntary basis, and asking people to spend their evenings and weekends working on a project when they have work commitments, family commitments, personal commitments, it is a big ask. But I think it's, if you have a group that is really focused on it, then I think it's load-bearing for each other as well. You know, there will be times when some people just can't do it, but equally, they'll be able to step into the breach when somebody else is busy. The short answer is I don't know what the secret is. I wish I did, but I think there's ways around it. And I think once, especially if you've got the rights, then that kind of momentum drives it forward.
Jazz, have you got any thoughts on that?
I was kind of hesitating around the whole question of money, because for me, I didn't get involved to get any financial gain from the whole project. But as the time has gone on, I've suddenly had a new light shone on, you know, the £5 note, because it's not so much about money, filthy lucre, as about value, you know, the value of your work. And so I think as you take on a project like this, the further it goes, the more professional you need to be, and the more professional you inevitably will become in order to take it on. And so at some point, you know, there's got to be some payback.
I completely agree. It's a real issue in environmentalism as a whole, that you've got all these people trying to save the planet, and most of them are interns and they're working for nothing and they're doing it in their spare time. And you have to wonder, you know, how much do we really value this effort of trying to clean up our own mess? I mean, would it help? Does it help from the beginning to say to people, we're going to pay you at least this, you know, so that we show that we value your time?
I think there's a problem right at the beginning doing that, because you just, when you start the investigation process, you don't even know whether or not there's going to be a viable project there. You don't know what it's likely to generate. So it's difficult to make that kind of determination about what it would be. That said, I don't think there's any problem saying initially, we'd really like you to be involved, we'd like you to work, and when it gets to the point where this is viable, we will be making, you know, we will ensure that you are compensated for your time and for your effort. Because, you know, going back to the business analogy, people in business don't work for free. And if you look at the kind of projects that various energy developers are doing up and down the country, you can bet your bottom dollar that none of them are doing it for free. So when it comes to that, if you apply the same logic to community groups, it's as Chaz said, it's the kind of unspoken thing that people don't want to mention.
Yeah. But, no, they're afraid to mention it, and you shouldn't mention it. You should mention it, rather. You know, your time is valuable, and as I say, you're on a steep learning curve. You're meeting lots of people. I imagine you've been in meetings for more than a year now with all kinds of people.
Today, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And we're leaving for one now, probably. but also, I think it's kind of a shock to the system. It must be a shock to the system when you start this sort of thing, because if your community has consisted of, you know, three or four neighbors on either side, and suddenly you're dealing with the wider community and all their needs, that's got to be really difficult and really challenging.
It's a challenge, but I think that a project like this, as far as I'm concerned, and my experience shows, is that it's grown in an organic way. So as we've gone along, we've learned various things, and so we've been able to, I suppose, take account of those factors. You know, what is our responsibility to the wider community? Who is the wider community? I mean, that's quite a big question. In our sense, we've got a fairly good idea, and we've started with a fairly well-defined geographical area that we say is our community, that's who we're trying to benefit, both in, you know, terms of economics and in terms of cohesion, etc., and all the added benefits. But, you know, even that is questionable. Who is the community? We're still learning. But as we go, I think, you know, if you're open enough to learn as you go, and you're also prepared to say, well, okay, I made a mistake here, but I'm still learning. There's one of the great things about transition movement that I read was, it's Rob Hopkins, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The sort of founder. That was basically his philosophy. That's it. That's it. You know, we're learning as we go. And I think that's such a liberating thought. I mean, okay, you can't make hideous mistakes, but
no, but not to be afraid to make.
Not to be afraid.
Yeah.
And genuinely just to say, I'm still open.
Have you made mistakes?
I think
that you can talk about
diplomatic mistakes here and there. I don't think they've been particularly major. I hope not. Anyway. We've had disagreements, you know, with various people along the way, like, you know, councillors, and, you know, that there have been moments where I've thought, well, did I do the right thing there? But, you know, you work as a team, you try to support each other, and as long as you've got the commitment and initiative to move forward, I think you can do that.
Is there anything that the government could be doing that it's not doing to support these kind of initiatives?
Yes, absolutely.
How long is the list?
Well, they've already said they're going to set up a green investment bank. And, I mean, that would be one smart way to just provide some initial seed funding for any community-led initiative like this.
I would imagine sort of ethically that would be quite important to some people. There's no point in having an environmentally friendly, clean, green energy thing that's being funded by a bank that's doing naughty things overseas.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, also, there are banks that are more ethically minded and some very ethically minded, and those are the first people that we've approached.
Mary?
I think it would be nice to see some more joined up thinking in government. I mean, both parties in government had a pledge in their manifestos that, you know, they would support renewable energy projects owned by the community. And it even made it into the coalition agreement, which was nice to see. But you don't always get that feeling when you talk to various agencies of government. And it would be nice if that message would get down to all of the organisations who will actually be dealing with community groups. I think there is still a perception in a lot of places that, oh, that's nice, that's a nice bunch of enthusiasts kind of thing. But actually, it's not. It's a bunch of really serious, committed people who are doing this. And, you know, you as a government, you've claimed that you're going to support it. So can you please make sure that all the people that they're going to deal with do actually know what the role is as well?
Yes, it's quite dismissive, isn't it, this idea that you know, the nice folksy feel of community generation. But clearly from Ham Hydro, you know, you're doing something really big and really professional. You don't want to be just dismissed as a bunch of yokels that are trying to do good.
We have been called enthusiasts, and that calls to mind, you know, people with their Hornby 00 railway sets, and that's just I don't think that's applicable in this case.
No,
we've put far too much into it to be dismissed. No.
What do you think is the biggest challenge you've got coming up with Ham Hydro now?
Well, that's a good question. It's this next step, I think, from having come so many steps to where we are now, which is basically just about to develop this project in earnest. That is the big hurdle. We need to move to that next stage of professionalisation as a unit, and the funding aspect is also a major. It's a major hurdle, but it's not. You know, we can get there. We can get over that hurdle. But that is probably the biggest hurdle at the moment.
And can anyone do this, Mary? Is it just as practical on a small housing estate as it is in larger, you know, more well-to-do areas that have more resources, perhaps?
I think it is. It is practical. I guess it comes down to the point that Chaz was talking about, the time and energy that people need to invest in it. You don't always get people with that, you know. How do you harness the collective energy of a group of people who don't have a lot of time? It's quite a difficult thing to do. But I think it again comes back to things like the local food movement. Sometimes just putting the idea out there and all of a sudden you can find other like-minded people around you. And once that starts to happen, then yes, it is practical. And actually, you know, if you look at a local housing, think of the amount of roof space, think of what you could do with that in terms of solar panels. So it's just really having the vision and having the imagination and then taking that next step.
Okay. And can I ask you just briefly, and this is a personal question. I like to end with a personal question, if I can. What makes this work of creating local energy meaningful to you personally?
Mine comes from, I find it unbelievably rewarding. My background, I started off in the oil and gas industry and I started off working abroad and saw how illogical it was and it just was not going to be my future. So moving into renewable energy has been enormously rewarding, and seeing it on a local scale is even more rewarding because it is a real testament to the power of what people can do when they put their mind to it.
Fantastic. Chaz?
Yeah, it's what inspires me is seeing people feeling that they can make a big difference in their community. And also what really inspires me is the vision of a genuinely sustainable existence.
That's fantastic. I am so inspired by having you guys in today. And that is sadly all we have time for. We could probably go on for about an hour. Next week, as we are in the middle of the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, we're going to be talking about urban foraging. We may not be much good at hunting anymore, but our ancient gathering instincts get some exercise right here in the city. You just have to know where to look and what you're looking at. So until next week, tread lightly. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.